The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Randall Kennedy. Celebrated for his courage and his convictions in tackling sensitive issues, Randall Kennedy is what the Washington Post calls a, quote, member of that small coterie of our most lucid big thinkers about race. The Michael R. Klein Professor at Harvard Law School, he formerly held positions at the United States Court of Appeals and at the U.S. Supreme Court, where he clerked for Thurgood Marshall. His many books include Interracial Intimacies, The Persistence of the Color Line, For Discrimination. He is here tonight with his new book, Say It Loud. In it, he offers a collection of provocative essays in topics ranging from George Floyd, birtherism, Clarence Thomas, anti-racism, and more. A review in the New York Times states that in almost everything about his views on race in America, Kennedy is both resolutely temperate and probably right. Randall, thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your offering this forum to me, and I look forward to interacting with our audience after I say a bit about this collection of essays that has recently been published. I'm going to proceed by just describing some of the essays in this book. Say It Loud is a collection of 29 essays. They are pieces that were written over the past 20 years. Some of the pieces, many of the pieces, have been published before, but I've gone over all of them, even the ones that have been published before, and I've revised, I've updated, I've corrected. On occasion, I have apologized for what I think were misjudgments, previous misjudgments. So all of these essays really do contain my thinking as of my current thinking. But I've certainly been happy to indicate places where my mind has changed over the years. But let me mention a couple of the essays in this book. Let me begin with the first essay. The first essay is called Shall We Overcome Optimism and Pessimism in African American Racial Thought? And what I say in this essay is that racial thinking among Black Americans can be situated into two camps. This is just one way of trying to make sense of the very broad spectrum of African American thinking. There are other ways, of course, in which one could try to make sense of this, you know, this broad spectrum, this highly varied spectrum of thought, but this is just one way of doing it. And so what I say in this essay is that you can discern two broad camps. One camp is the camp that says, that answers, yes, we shall overcome. It's the optimistic tradition, the tradition that believes that we can in this country overcome the history of racism, the history of racial oppression, and that we can become a multiracial republic in which people are considered equals. That's one view. Another view is a pessimistic view. It's the point of view that says, no, we should not overcome. That racial hierarchy is baked into American life, and that racial hierarchy will prevail. It will continue. There will be no racial equality in the United States. There will not be a happy ending to the American racial saga. Now, let me go a little bit further into these two different camps. The optimistic camp is, in the 19th century, the great spokesperson for the optimistic camp would be Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, even before the abolition of slavery, Frederick Douglass was asked once, can you foresee a time when people of different races will view one another as equal neighbors? Do you see such a time? And he answered, yes, I do. Now, this is before the abolition of slavery, and this is coming from a person who, you know, bore the scars of slavery. This man was, of course, enslaved, ran away from slavery, knew slavery intimately, knew racism intimately. But he was an optimist. He said that, you know, things can change, people can change, we shall overcome. In the Frederick Douglass in the 19th century, in the 20th century, the great spokesperson in the optimistic tradition. There are a number of people, but if one person that I think stands out would be Martin Luther King Jr. Think of I Have a Dream. Or think of, so I Have a Dream, probably his most well-known utterance, but then one might also point to the his last speech as a civil rights leader, when he talked about hours before he's killed. You know, I've been to the mountaintop, and I've seen the promised land. I might not get there with you, but I've seen the promised land. I mean, he has in mind overcoming. He has in mind reaching the promised land. In the 21st century, probably the most consequential racial optimist was Barack Obama. Barack Obama, aware of racial oppression, but yes, we can. And think of the night that he was elected president of the United States. All things are possible in America. Very optimistic. The pessimistic camp. In the pessimistic camp, in a way, the pessimistic camp is more interesting, actually, than the optimistic camp. It certainly has a broader range of people. In the pessimistic camp, on the one hand, you have people like, Alexis de Tocqueville. Alexis de Tocqueville, obviously not a Black American thinker. There are a number of white American thinkers that white Americans or whites, Tocqueville, of course, from France, who thought hard about the race question in America. And I talk about them and bring them into my discussion about Black American thinkers. My point is, there were whites who were in the optimistic tradition. I didn't mention them, but there are whites in the optimistic tradition. There are whites in the pessimistic tradition. Among the most pessimistic thinkers about race are white observers. So Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America. De Tocqueville had a chapter called The Three Races of America. The three races that he discussed: whites, Blacks, Native Americans. And it's a very dark vision. De Tocqueville said, no, there won't be racial equality in the United States. Never. Even after slavery is done away with, there's not going to be racial equality. And his basic theory was that the conjunction, the confluence of, on the one hand, racial difference, clear racial difference, and slavery. He said, you put those two things together, even after slavery is abolished, people will know who were the folks who were enslaved. He said, you know, he basically said, I come from an aristocratic society. I come from a society that knows about pecking orders. But he said, you know, in a society in which you can't tell who was who just right off the bat, you can't just look at somebody and look at the color of their skin and tell who was who. He said, well, under those circumstances, with enough, you know, change in society, enough time has passed, you don't know who was relegated to the lowest orders. But he said, you're going to always know that in America. So he had a very dark view. Other pessimists, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, in his notes on the state of Virginia, said, we're never going to have racial equality in America. The people who were enslaved will always remember, they'll have 1,000 memories of the horrors of enslavement. And the whites will have the memory too. Very Jefferson, very dark view. No, we're not gonna overcome. Abraham Lincoln. One of the reasons why Abraham Lincoln was very interested in colonization throughout his adult life, very interested in colonization, was because he did not think that whites and blacks could occupy the United States on an equal basis and live together in harmony. So he was always very interested in the idea of black people going someplace else, going, you know, back to Africa, going to Panama, going someplace, but not staying in America. And you know, he thought that this was actually for the good of everybody, but especially for black people, because he didn't think that white people would ever accommodate themselves to being on an equal basis with black people. Among black Americans in the pessimistic tradition, you have black nationalists, you know, Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, the Nation of Islam. I mean, you know, in the black, in at least in a large faction of black nationalist thinking, you have people who say, no, this is a white man's country. Has been from the beginning, will continue to be a white man's country. Therefore, black people need to do something else. Black people need to either have some sort of inward migration and develop a certain, you know, a separate identity within the United States, or leave the United States. I mean, there are plenty of black people who have. There's certainly been plenty of efforts to leave the United States. And so in my essay, I go through all of that. Now, where am I? Where am I on this? This issue, this, you know, optimism, pessimism, has a deep personal meaning to me because largely because of my father. My father was a thoroughgoing pessimist. Thoroughgoing pessimist. My father was born in Louisiana and had a very tough upbringing and saw many terrible things. And he endured racist affronts. One of the racist affronts that I know left a scar with him had to do with the treatment of Black American soldiers in World War II. He would talk about how, Black American soldiers wearing the uniform of the United States, being willing to risk serious injury, even death, in defense of the United States, those soldiers were told that they could not go to places where white German prisoners of war were allowed to go. My father thought that the United States of America had betrayed Black Americans, and he was not willing to forget or forgive what he perceived to be that terrible betrayal. And so he did not think we would overcome. He had a very dark vision, and we talked about this as I was, in my household, as I was growing up. So I was very aware of the pessimistic tradition. One wonderful thing about my dad, he had very strong feelings, but he was not dictatorial. He wanted his children to be educated, and he wanted them to develop ideas of their own, and he gave space for the generation of alternative ideas. And I grew up becoming generally an optimist, and I have remained part of the optimistic camp, believing that the general trajectory of Black America has been a trajectory up and, up. John Hope Franklin's wonderful book on Black American history, From Slavery to Freedom. That's generally been my view. And I'm a fan of I revere the champions of racial justice. And my sense is that, America, of course, has had a terrible history, but that's not all there is. It also has a glorious history of struggle against racism. There has been a long tradition of racists, but there's also been a long tradition of anti-racists. And through heroic, persistent, intelligent struggle, things have been made better. So I've generally been an optimist. I end this essay by talking, however, about how I have been shaken over the past few years. I thought we were further down the road to racial decency than we are. The ascendancy of Donald Trump and the racial ideas that he tapped and that he encouraged, that he tolerated, I was really quite taken aback by that. I don't think I was sentimental. I knew that there were racial resentments around, of course, but I did not know that those racial resentments would be as powerful as we have seen that they are. And so I still put myself in the optimistic camp, but I don't have the confidence that I once had. I'm shaken with my optimism has been shaken. And a few years ago, I used to be rather chastising toward people who, were basically pessimists. And I've had to change my the tenor of my discussion of this issue. Unfortunately, it's tragic. I think that I see our present and our future with through a prism that is tinctured with more uncertainty, tinctured with more tragedy than in previous years. So that was, that was the first essay, and it's one of the longer essays, and I think it's one of the more important essays in the book. Let me talk about my second one. Second essay in the book is an essay called Derrick Bell and Me. This is an essay that has never been published before. I spent a lot of time on this essay. Let me just spend just a little bit of time talking about Derrick Bell and Me. Derrick Bell was the first black tenured professor at Harvard Law School. And he's been in the news lately because many people, critical race theory. Well, Derrick Bell is viewed by many who call themselves critical race theorists as sort of the godfather of critical race theory. And I have written an essay in which I discuss his ideas and I discuss my relationship with him. When I joined the faculty of Harvard Law School, he was actually not there. He had been on the faculty. But when I came, he had left. He had left to become the dean of the University of Oregon Law School. And that's where he was for my first few years on the faculty at Harvard Law School. And then he came back. And when he came back, we met, we talked, we were friendly. I had basically taken over a course that he had created. He had a course at Harvard Law School, popular course, well-known course, Race, Racism in American Law. And I started teaching that course and I started writing articles about race relations law. And again, our relationship was an interesting relationship because on one level, we were friends, close friends. For one thing, we shared a we had a we had a tie that was a tragic tie. His first wife died because of cancer, and my wife of blessed memory was a cancer surgeon. And Professor Bell's wife was not one of my wife's patients, but we knew them. And my wife talked with Mrs. Bell quite a bit, and we'd go visit in the hospital. And then years later, well, his wife died, and then years later, my wife passed away. So we had that in common, and we had other things in common, and we talked, and we were quite friendly. He was very he was nice to me as a senior colleague. He encouraged me. He encouraged my work. He opened doors for me, and I was very appreciative of that. The difficulty, or at least one difficulty, is that my views really diverged from his. So one big divergence was that over time he developed an idea. He was a pessimist. I talked about the pessimist tradition. Derrick Bell was a very important voice in the pessimistic tradition in the 20th century. He had a view, his view was that pigmentocracy in America was a permanent condition. He was an activist. He was all for struggling to change things. But he basically said, we need to struggle just as an ethical matter. We need to struggle. We need to try to see that justice is done. But his view was, realistically speaking, justice is not going to be done in America. We shall not overcome. Well, I criticized his views, and I said, well, you know, over the course of, you know, you're not going to tell me that there's no difference between the racial landscape in 1970 as opposed to, let's say, 1950. I mean, you know, what about the Civil Rights Act of 1957, Civil Rights Act of 1960, Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act of 1965, Open Housing Act of 1968? What about Brown versus Board of Education, Loving versus Virginia, on and on and on? Clearly there has been change in America, not as much as we would like, to be sure, but the idea that there's really been that, you know, the changes that have happened are merely peripheral, they don't really amount to a whole lot, I thought that was untenable, and I said so. And there were other ways in which we really differed, you know, sometimes quite sharply. And he took after me in print, and I took after him in print. And it led to some hard feelings. And in this essay, I talk about our relationship. So for instance, just one more thing with this. I wrote a piece once in which I criticized some of his thinking. I criticized the thinking of some other people who are identified now with critical race theory. And I sent him my article ahead of time, just, you know, to get his views. You know, here's what I've written. I'd be really interested in your reactions. And he wrote me a letter back, and he said, he gave me his reactions, and then he said, I urge you strongly not to publish this. The ideas that you voice will be harmful. You don't need to publish it. Don't publish it. Well, I published it, and he really held that against me. And I talk about why I published it and all of that. Let me give the ending. The ending of the essay talks about our the way we ended up. Very late in his life, I heard that he was very ill, and I called him up. And I basically said, you know, listen, I hear you're under the weather, but, you know, do know that from afar, I'm pulling for you. And we had a very nice talk. And then a bit later, he called me up and he said, listen, I'm you know, really quite ill. Would you be interested in teaching a session of a seminar that I'm giving? By this time, he had left Harvard Law School. He famously resigned from Harvard Law School in protest. Harvard Law School, when he resigned, did not have any black women on its faculty, and he put down an ultimatum. He said, "Listen, Harvard Law School, by a certain time, you better have hired a black woman. And if you have not, I'm not going to teach anymore." And he stood by his ultimatum and ultimately left Harvard Law School. He went to New York University Law School, and that's where he was teaching at the end of his career, at the end of his life. And I went to teach this session, and I taught it. And I taught it 1 week after he had passed away, but we did have one final conversation on the phone, and I was able to express, you know, my gratitude to him and my deep respect for him. And I think we, at the very end, I think we were able to reach a reconciliation, which was very meaningful to me. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this essay is it was my effort to pay my respects to Derek Bell. And one of the ways in which I wanted to pay my respects to him was to be open, be candid, say where I agreed with him, but also say where I disagreed with him. I think you show respect to a thinker by taking their ideas seriously enough to criticize. And that's what I attempted to do in this essay. There are a bunch, well, like I said, there are 29 essays. There's an essay about the events of last summer, the George Floyd moment, Promise and Peril. There's an essay about the struggles on various university campuses regarding memorialization. Do you keep the name, you know, John C. Calhoun? That was an issue at Yale. Do you keep the name at my alma mater, Princeton University? Do you keep the name Woodrow Wilson? Or do you demote the name? Do you take the name off of a school, off of a building? This is an issue that's come up over and over at various places, and I give my ideas about that. I talk about Justice Clarence Thomas, whom I harshly criticize. I have an essay, well, I think the title will give you a hint of where I stand, Why Clarence Thomas Ought to Be Ostracized. I have a long piece about the great Thurgood Marshall. And I got a lot of pleasure out of writing that piece. I clerked for Justice Marshall in the 1983-1984 Supreme Court term. It was one of the highlights of my life. And I talk about Thurgood Marshall's career in that essay. And again, there are other pieces in this collection. But I think I've given you a sufficient, I've been talking long enough, I've given you a sufficient sense of the sorts of things that I cover in this collection. And why don't we now turn to your questions and turn this monologue into a dialogue. Thank you so much for listening to me. And now I look forward to interacting with you through questions, answers, and by all means, objections. I can imagine that maybe some of you object to something that I've said or object to something that I've written, and the floor is open to objections as well. So thank you.
Okay. Oh, I brought my gavel here so I can overrule any objections. So, okay, here's a softball to begin with. Perhaps a bit off, and I'm just going straight down the list, perhaps a bit off topic, but I'm curious who the artist of the pieces, who painted the pieces that are behind you?
Those are Romare Bearden. And those are Romare Bearden prints. My wife of blessed memory was an artist as well as a surgeon, and was, you know, the art world was a big interest of hers. And so that's what's in back of me.
In the spirit of Absalom Jones of the Free African Society, Richard Allen of the AME Church. Yeah, okay, softball straight to in-depth question. Of the fifth Pan-African Congress, 1945, Black Political Convention. Okay, so the question here is, were you present? This is a very specific date, Monday, October 16th, 1995 in Washington, D.C. And what are your thoughts about the resilience of African people in America. What thoughts can you glean from these through lines? So I think there's a lot of questions in here.
Not altogether sure what the question is. I mean, the references were to, I guess, a version of the Black nationalist tradition. And like I said, in my essay on optimism and pessimism, I talk about the Black nationalist strain within the pessimistic tradition. On the question of, you know, resilience, Black Americans have shown absolutely remarkable resilience. And, you know, the story of Black Americans is a remarkable story, not only in terms of American history, it's remarkable in terms of world history. I mean, 1865 is not really that long ago. You really think about it. 1865, not that long ago. In 1865, there were 4 million Black people had recently been released from, you know, hereditary bondage. 4 million Black people, hereditary bondage, had been prevented. It was against the law in many, many slave jurisdictions. It was against the law to teach Black people how to read or write. You had approximately a half million free, but 4 million, there have been about 500,000 free Blacks during the age of, you know, in the end of the slavery era, but 4 million who had been in bondage. And take a look at what has occurred. Take a look at what that group of people has been able to do in the face of tremendous resistance. I mean, you have the abolition of slavery, you have Reconstruction, 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, you have that relatively brief period of time in which Black people become, or at least Black men are allowed to become politically active as voters, as office holders. You have a relatively brief period, and then redemption. You have this terrible, this destructive reaction that throws Black people back. But, you know, Black people get it together and are able to husband their resources, organize, and build a movement that leads to a second Reconstruction. And, you know, I mean, I think that that's important to remember. It's important to remember the obstacles. It's also important to remember the overcoming of the obstacles. So, you know, with your question about, you know, Black people and resilience, Black people have shown absolutely remarkable resilience and have a story that is filled with heroism, filled with beauty, filled with a desire for decency, for human realization, for everyone. There are so many things that are part of American life that are attributable to Black people's struggles. So let me talk about another essay that's in my book, one that I had a lot of fun writing. It's called let's see here. Yeah, the sixth essay, How Black Students Brought the Constitution to Campus. I mean, for any student, Before 1960, students at public universities had virtually no constitutional rights. As a matter of law, a student at a public university could be tossed out by the authorities at the university anytime. Students were basically on campus at will. This changed in the early 1960s. The key case, sort of the breakthrough case, was a case called St. John Dixon versus Alabama State Board of Education. What happened was St. John Dixon and some other black students at Alabama State College engaged in a sit-in. They went to a courthouse. This was in Montgomery, Alabama. They went to a courthouse, and in this courthouse was an eating facility that was segregated. They sat in to protest that. The governor of the state heard about this, calls up the president of Alabama State College and says, throw these students out, expel them. And the governor made it clear that he meant business, that unless these students were immediately expelled, the institution would be put in danger. So the president expelled them. They fought that. They took the university to court. They took the state to court. They lost at the federal district court level. But then they appealed their case to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The United States Court of Appeals reversed the district court and said, you know what? These students were at least, the students were entitled to at least a hearing. Not clear that they're going to prevail, but they are at least entitled to a hearing. You can't just summarily expel them. That was the beginning of the idea that students at public universities have constitutional rights. One more case. 4 years later, this was in 1960, the case that I just mentioned. 4 years later, in 1964, some high school students in Mississippi, black high school students, go to school wearing a button, a freedom button. The button had SNCC on it, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it also had one man, one vote. So they wear these buttons to school. The principal of the school tells these students, either you can stay here, but you got to take the button off. If you keep the button on, go home. Well, some students took the button off, but some students said, we're not taking it off. And they were dismissed, they were sent home. Well, they and their parents got lawyers and sued, saying that their First Amendment rights had been violated. This was completely novel. This was novel. They lost at the district court level, but again, a United States Court of Appeals reversed and said, well, you know, there's no evidence that the students are disrupting anything. There's no evidence that the mere wearing of this button is undercutting the educational mission of the high school. So long as the students are not disrupting anything, so, you know, they should be able to express themselves, you know, at school. Well, there was a Supreme Court case a few years later, Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District. That case is much more famous. That was a case involving students who were wearing armbands protesting the Vietnam War. When people think about the constitution, you know, constitutional rights for, especially for high school students, they think of Tinker. But previous to Tinker was the action taken by these black students in the Deep South. And so One could go on and on with that, how the struggle of black people in America has led to the betterment of society for everyone.
This is an interesting question. This person, Roland, would like to know, would you talk about your clerkship for Thurgood Marshall in what intellectual path it helped establish or guide you on? So intellectually, you know, academically speaking, that sort of thing.
Well, like I said before, clerking for Justice Marshall was one of the great highlights of my life. His name was a name that was quite, he was spoken of with just reverence in my household. My father saw Thurgood Marshall argue a case in 1948. Very interesting case called Rice versus Elmore. And what the case was about in prior to this case, prior to 1947, in South Carolina, black people were not permitted to participate in the primaries of the Democratic Party. Now, this was very important because, you know, South Carolina was at that time basically a one-party state. Whoever the primary was the important election. Whoever won a Democratic Party primary in South Carolina, that was the person who was going to, you know, occupy whatever seat was being contested. And the Democratic Party of South Carolina had as one of its rules, you know, this is only for white people. That was now that was put into jeopardy by a case, Smith versus Allwright, 1944 case, in which the Texas white primary was invalidated by the Supreme Court of the United States. South Carolina responded. South Carolina tried to get around Smith versus Allwright in various ways that I needn't get into here. They tried to evade Smith versus Allwright. And George Elmore, black man, sought to vote. He wasn't permitted to vote, and he sued. And a federal court struck down the white primary in South Carolina, where my father went to see Thurgood Marshall argue the case. And he talked a lot about just going to see Mr. Civil Rights. He talked about how people would, in the Deep South, you know, trouble, something would happen. You know, people would say, you know, hold on, Thurgood's coming. And so, you know, I heard about Thurgood Marshall. And so when I worked for Thurgood Marshall, it was a thrill. Let me go back a moment. My father was not a lawyer. My father worked in the post office. He did not really talk much about the legal issue involved in Rice versus Elmore, but he did talk about this. The thing that struck him the most, and this will show how, you know, has there been change? My father was struck by the fact that the people in the courtroom called Thurgood Marshall Mr. Marshall. That stuck in my father's mind because under the etiquette of Jim Crow, black men were not called Mr. A black physician might be called Dr. So-and-so. A black minister might be called Reverend So-and-so. But a black man, ordinary parlance, just ordinary interaction, not called Mr. That was a big thing, not called Mr. They called Mr. Marshall. He was clearly the most impressive person in the courthouse, in the courtroom. And, you know, again, I heard about these. And so I worked for Justice Marshall, and I learned a lot from him. I asked him lots of questions. One of the great things about Justice Marshall was he was very willing to talk. He loved to tell stories. And his stories often had a message to them. And the message that he gave, one of the lessons was that, you know, law is important. Sure, law is important. It's not the only thing, though, that's important. And one must be very realistic about the limits of the law. He talked a lot about the limits of the law. And so, you know, have some of the lessons that I gleaned from my time with Thurgood Marshall, have they stuck with me? Have they affected, you know, the way I go about my work? The answer is yes.
Two very timely things I want to make sure that we get to tonight and that are asked by a multitude of people. So Marianne says, what is your take on voter restriction laws? Some people might not call them that, but we don't need to be political about that, being passed around this country. Do you see these laws as race-related? And if so, what does it say about the future? Yeah, I guess I would say to that, how do we approach these laws in regard to, I don't know, how we move forward as a country?
Yeah. Well, you've put your finger on a very troubling development. There has been a long-standing resistance to Black participation in the political sphere. We've seen it over and over and over again, and we're seeing another iteration of that. One of the things that's, I guess, especially troubling, especially terrible, is that earlier, in the last century, the Supreme Court, certainly in the last half of the last century, the Supreme Court would use its authority to, strike down racial disfranchisement and various ruses that amounted to racial disfranchisement. Now, unfortunately, we have a Supreme Court of the United States that is at best indifferent to these illicit efforts to restrict voting. The worst, of course, was its ruling of several years ago, Shelby County versus Holder, when the Supreme Court of the United States eviscerated the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I think that was 2013. That case, that decision, 5-4 decision, 5-4 decision, that was a judicial delinquency that will go down as one of the more disgraceful judicial delinquencies in the history of the Supreme Court. So I'm worried. I'm very worried about the voting, the effort to discourage people from voting. Is it racial? Clearly, it's racial. What do you mean? Is it only race? No, it's not only race. I mean, there's partisanship, partisan gerrymandering. Race is often not the only thing going on. But is race a big ingredient in this terrible stew? Answer, yes.
Briefly, and that was the other thing, and a few people had touched on this, and you were touching on it briefly, was the current state of the Supreme Court. You know, there was an article today saying, you know, a conservative justice should retire to, you know, maintain, to create perhaps a better balance on the court. And few people are approaching that question and are talking about this here. Do you see a way back to parity on the Supreme Court anytime soon? Is there a remedy?
Listen, the Supreme Court of the United States is at the top of one of the three branches of the federal government. It is a powerful, law-giving institution, just like the presidency, just like the Congress. It is political, just like the presidency, just like the Congress. I think a lot of people have this sentimental, you know, unrealistic notion that, you know, the court is above politics. And of course, members of the court tell the public that. They try to make the public believe that. They articulate that view. The Chief Justice during his confirmation hearings talked about, well, the justices are merely umpires. They're not players. You know, ridiculous. Similarly ridiculous is, you know, the statements made by the senior member of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court, Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer has just published a book in which he talks about the perils of politics, and, you know, the justices are outside of politics. Again, you know, ridiculous. It's a political matter. It's going to be a political struggle. The ideological complexion of the Supreme Court of the United States will be determined by political struggle. That's the way it has been. That's the way it will be. So the idea of trying to create reforms that will take the Supreme Court out of politics seems to me that that's, no, I think what you need to do is have good politics. Good politics will result in, you know, good justices who will be in favor of good policies. Will it be political? Yes, but at least it'll be good as opposed to bad. And right now, unfortunately, we are saddled with a reactionary Supreme Court that is a friend, certainly a friend of big business, a friend of those on top, a friend of, you know, the, frankly, some of the worst aspects of our status quo. And it's indifferent or unfriendly, certainly to organized labor, unfriendly toward people who have been marginalized, unfriendly towards people who are trying to change our country in a substantial way, ways that are very needed. We need substantial change. And the Supreme Court, unfortunately, as presently constituted, is going to stand in the way. It's going to be an obstacle. It's going to be an impediment. It's not going to be a source of assistance for those who are trying to reform our country, though our country is so deeply in need of reform.
Well, I think this is a great lead into our very last question here from Denise. It's good to end on a note like this. What makes you stay optimistic, she asks.
I'm going to end with a story involving Justice Marshall. Near the end of the 1983-84 term, there was a case, I believe it was a death penalty case. Justice Marshall had very deep feelings. He was a death penalty abolitionist. He thought that the death penalty was unconstitutional, and he said that. In any event, there was a death penalty case, and the prisoner had exhausted all of his legal avenues for, you know, for all of his pleas for relief had been denied. And I was talking with the justice, and I said, Justice Marshall, you really are on the losing end of a lot of the things that are most important to you. Don't you get discouraged? And he said to me, he said two things. He said, number one, he said, you know, you should remember that in much of my career as an attorney, with respect to equal protection cases, my lead case was Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. So, you know, everybody now, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson, terrible, you know, the idea of separate but equal, bad, bad, bad. But he said, you know, I tried to wring out as much equality from that myth, that terrible myth of separate but equal. I tried to wring out as much equality as I could. And he did ring out. He, you know, he even with Plessy versus Ferguson, he was able to advance a bit. So you remember that. Even when you're being dealt bad cards, even when things are really against you, even under those circumstances, you can find tools to use to advance. Then secondly, he said, remember, this is not a sprint. This is a marathon. So am I discouraged? No, I'm not discouraged. I'm, you know, sometimes I get disappointed, but this, you got to take the long view and you got to keep pushing. And I've taken that on board. I think that's a good way of viewing things.
Well, thank you. And I can't think of a better way to end tonight. And I'd like to thank you for joining us and thank everybody at home. And we encourage you to purchase the book. It's called Say It Loud. Professor Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Really appreciated it.
All right. Thanks again. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author